Welcome to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life. My name is Tracy Crow. I'm an author, writing coach, and Marine Corps veteran. I'm looking forward to co-creating today's show with you. So if you're ready, are you ready? I'm ready. So if you're ready to live a more creative, more magical life, let's get started. As most of you know by now, Accept Your Gifts has taken a short production break, but no way could we miss an opportunity to return with a special segment, because you see, the novel titled No Salvation that we discussed in episodes 22 and 23 with author and Navy veteran Jeffrey Hess just released yesterday, Memorial Day. And today, Jeff is back to read an excerpt from No Salvation. But before we hear from Jeff, let me take a few moments to reintroduce him to you. Jeff is the author of the novels Tush Hog and Beachhead and the story collection Cold War Canoe Club, as well as editor of the award-winning anthologies Home of the Brave, Stories in Uniform, and Home of the Brave, Somewhere in the Sand. Jeff served 6 years aboard the Navy's oldest and newest ships and has held writing positions at a daily newspaper, a Fortune 500 company, and a university-based research center. He holds writing degrees from Queen's University of Charlotte and the University of South Florida. Jeff's writing has appeared widely in print and online. He lives in Florida, where he leads the DD-214 Writer's Workshop for Military Veterans. Now, you may remember from episode 22, we heard Jeff talk about creating fiction from actual events. And Jeff, he just has this innate ability of turning real life events into literary gold. So, for a setup about the excerpt you're about to hear from No Salvation, let me share the premise as described by Jeff's publisher. Quote, No Salvation features the USS Salvation as it sails for months on end in the South China Sea in the violent closing days of the Vietnam War. Exhaustion, drugs, and discontent run rampant aboard ship, and crew morale is at an all-time low. These conditions affect 4,000 men being sequestered for months on end without port visits and has everyone on edge. This is 1972, a time when inequality and racial tension permeated ships fleet-wide. As a way to mitigate racial unrest, the ship's captain brings in Commander Robert Porter as his executive officer. Commander Porter isn't sure if he's been selected for the job because of his skills or for the color of his skin, but the black crew doesn't accept him. Amid rampant drug use and various forms of sabotage, the biggest challenge to the ship's performance and the crew's safety is a series of violent attacks made by planes launching from the flight deck. But more perilous are the racial tensions boiling below. Porter is uniquely positioned to save them all, but can he? And if so, at what cost? Unquote. By the way, to purchase your copy of No Salvation, just follow the link in the description of today's podcast. And now, here's author Jeffrey Hess reading from No Salvation.
Chapter 1. USS Salvation, CV-44, Yankee Station, Tonkin Gulf, October 31st, 1972. Of all the ways Commander Robert Porter had witnessed death, he never expected this. It was 0200. All lights aboard ship had been switched to red following taps 4 hours earlier. Porter double-timed it along passageways and down ladders and sprinted aft, all through the dim red glow that radiated off every pipe and cable run. Breath came easy and deep despite his heightened alertness. With each urgent step, the odors of wet iron and jet fuel made his mouth hot with a taste of rust. He slowed along the starboard passageway on the second deck, where broken glass crunched beneath his boots. Shadows in the red light played tricks. He stopped and leaned forward. Lengths of 1.5-inch fire hose lay unspooled, their nozzles missing, as were various dogging wrenches, except for one sticking out of a fuel transfer gauge attached to a port side bulkhead. He cleared his throat of the rising heat. This main thoroughfare should have been wide open, with less than a third of the ship's crew awake to get in his way. "Make a hole," he called out, intent on resuming his pace. No one moved. Farther down the passageway, through the red glow, those crewmen were not milling about, but rather slumped along the deck, many motionless, with open wounds, leaking blood. Porter's stomach felt like it had been kicked, and his nervous eye twitched. There had been no alarm or missile impact, not even heavy seas, yet dozens of casualties surrounded him. Those who were able applied direct pressure or tourniquets. As he stepped over Seaman Runyon, a young striker from Postal, his boot slipped in a puddle of blood. Gravity almost dragged Porter to the deck with his wounded crewman. The kid looked nearly unconscious, sprawled on the deck. "Someone applied direct pressure to the postal clerk's head," Porter called out. "Now!" Despite blood pouring like hydraulic fluid from his scalp, Runyon's eyes opened in time to focus on Porter. The blood covering the kid's face made his skin look as dark as Porter's. Runyon waved an arm as if weakly mocking semaphore performed topside on the flight deck and signal bridge. Blood and confusion filled his face. "Mr. Porter, please," he called out. His head wound percolated into his mouth. "They ran aft." The way he said the word "they" made Porter's windpipe grow tight. He looked past the multitude of injuries, contusions, and smeared blood and wished it wasn't true. The red light obscured colors, but the contrast was plain enough. All the casualties were white. "Mr. Porter," Runyon called out in the voice that might not live through the night. "Please, sir, make the other blacks stop." Porter's neck shivered beneath the weight of the kid's words. To keep himself upright, he reached out a hand to the yellow casing of an emergency light fixture. As an Airedale with a broken arm pulled his t-shirt over his head and used his good hand to staunch the blood flowing from his buddy's face, synapses in Porter's brain fired with the message to keep moving. First aid and mass casualties had procedures, but there was no script for being attacked from within. Nothing of the kind had been part of Porter's crisis at sea training. He had to keep going, despite the wet puzzlement on that postal clerk's face. Nervous energy propelled Porter faster despite the heaviness threatening to drag him to his knees. With each step, his stomach churned more. He wondered if the color of his own skin would help or hurt his efforts to restore calm aboard the ship. A dozen frames down the passageway, red lights made a tunnel leading to white lights. His eyes adjusted to the brightness the closer he got to the mess deck. The smell of blood mixed in the air with fumes of jet fuel, old coffee, body odor, pot smoke, and bad breath. Instead of the empty tables and chairs where 12,000 meals were eaten daily, Porter arrived in time to see a firefighting nozzle swung as a weapon from its brass handle. It shined in the light of fluorescent bulbs overhead as it spun midair toward a blonde kid's head. "No!" Porter called out. The crowd buzzed with cheers and rage. Bulkheads vibrated with animosity. The kid had kneeled on the deck beside an ammo elevator, surrounded not by missiles or bombs, but by 150 black men, 151 counting Porter. They were in various degrees of uniform, some bare-chested with blood smeared on their faces, some with dilated pupils from smoking, snorting, or shooting smack, many others high from the fog of marijuana in the air. Their fists were still clenched. The blonde kid's face bore wounds pounded and kicked into it earlier. As Porter noticed the hula girl tattoo on the kid's forearm and the anguish in his young eyes, that 10-pound nozzle struck the side of his blonde head, ruptured skin, shattered bone across the eyes and the bridge of his nose, opened his skull like a can of dog food. Porter gagged low in his gut and covered his mouth with his fist. The kid's body slumped and his shoulder hit the deck without sound. His head thudded wet upon impact. Porter's first instinct was to call for a corpsman, but it was already too late. During his career, Porter had dropped ordnance on villages, so death was nothing new to him. He'd made peace with it so he could have a chance of sleeping at night. But seeing something so senseless, so violent, up close and personal, made him want to vomit. No one spoke. The only sound was heavy breathing and an ice maker along the far bulkhead as it pulled water and coughed a handful of cubes into its gray storage bin. Halfway between that ice maker and Porter stood Rufus Applewhite, a pissed-off brother all of 20 years old, in a blood-stained T-shirt and faded dungarees, with a monkey-fist keychain hanging out of his pocket. He dropped the nozzle. The brass thunked hard onto the deck. He walked toward Porter, his stare full of defiance. The black sailor shifted side to side, opened and closed their fists like athletes preparing to compete. They stood in random packs like wolves among the tables and chairs where they'd eaten every meal for the past 274 days. Only a couple of them tried to conceal weapons improvised from firefighting equipment, dogging wrenches, and aircraft tie-down chains. Porter recognized a few faces, but every one of them knew who he was and what he might be worth to their cause. He watched the dead kid's blood puddle widen beneath his head. The men stared at Porter as Applewhite ambled up slow and cocky. Pressure built in Porter's chest where wise words should have been. Applewhite walked the long way, going around the group instead of cutting through it. The ball of the monkey fist bounced with each step. Applewhite stepped up, toe to toe, so close Porter smelt pot on his breath and felt the rage radiating from the angry crowd into the deck plates and up the bulkheads. It made Porter feel like he was plummeting through the air. He spread his feet to give himself a stronger base, digging in, intent on manufacturing the power to calm his black crew. 10 weeks earlier, the bosun blew his pipe over the 1MC to signal an announcement to follow. What came next was the last thing Porter expected. "This is the captain speaking. Listen up. We have a new rule aboard this fine vessel, and that rule is the two-man rule for all black crew. Until further notice, no black crewmen are allowed to move about the ship in numbers greater than two at a time. That means no groups of three walking anywhere at any time. Those found in violation will be brought to me for NJP. That is all." Upon completing his berthing space inspection, Porter went in pursuit of the captain. He climbed up to the bridge, checked his sea cabin, popped into CIC, and then finally found him in his private galley. There was no mess cook present, just a stool, a sandwich, and the captain. "Did you make that yourself?" Porter asked. "Haven't eaten all day. Didn't want to wait anymore. But that's not why you're here." He took a chomp from the sandwich with his mouth full and said, "What can I do for you?" It seemed an absurd environment to have such an important conversation, but Porter had to take advantage of the urgency. "Sir, can I speak frankly?" "Of course." "This two-man rule is a horrible policy, and I strenuously advise you to reconsider."
"Advise me? As my XO or as a black man?"
"Both, obviously."
"Obviously? The only thing I'd say is obvious is your inability to bring me the head of the drug ring, to say nothing of your effect on black morale, thereby making this new rule necessary."
"Frankly, sir, I'm shocked you didn't consult me about this ahead of time." Porter was fuming inside. He'd recognized he was getting off topic and redirected himself. "There's a fire within much of the black crew. That's no secret. But what is the need to throw gas on it, sir?"
"If you're mad I didn't consult you, don't be," the captain said. "There was no way of talking me out of it. And if you're mad I didn't give you a heads up, don't be that either. I'd been contemplating it all about a month now. I spoke to the DCA earlier, and he put a bee in my bonnet to pull the trigger." Porter wasn't a fan of his terminology as it applied to the black crew, but the words were out, and the law had been laid. This is going to enrage every black man on this ship. "The thoughts and feelings of any swinging dick on this ship means little," the captain said. They only know objectives and numbers and exceeding expectations."
"None of that is possible," Porter said, "without the crew working together."
"Good," the captain said with smugness spread across his eyes and his slit of a mouth. "I'm glad you understand that fact. I wholly recommend you make that happen. Do I make myself clear?" Clear to the point of transparency, Captain. Don't get smart, Bob. Be smart, but don't get smart. He took another bite of sandwich. No good will come of that. Porter didn't have an objective way to judge the tone of his own voice, and he had no way to gauge how forceful he'd been in his opposition. The cold truth of it was the captain was right. Aye, Captain. But Senior and the Marines will have to go easy for the first few days as the crew adjusts. The captain wiped his mouth. Consider it done, Bob. Porter nodded as he contemplated the likelihood that would work out favorably. More than 90% of the men aboard this ship are white, Mr. Porter. Need I might remind you? Being black means I never need reminding. I'm thinking more about the safety of the black crew. The captain waved his sandwich. The blacks might have the element of surprise, but they're so outnumbered they wouldn't stand the chance, even without the Marines. Porter looked away. This is a powder keg, Smokey. We've got to keep the flame from the fuse. Porter shook his head in reflex to hearing something so absurd. But don't you understand, Captain? This new rule is the fuse, and you've just lit it. The captain took a swig of milk from his cup and then said, If that's true, it's a good thing this rule is in place. I'd rather have Senior or the Marines throw half of them in the brig than have to bury all of them. Them? Porter crossed his arms. That's all the black sailors are to a lot of guys aboard this ship. I grew up with boys like that. There are easily 2,000 of them redneck types aboard. There's another 1,000 that wouldn't go looking for trouble, but would quickly escalate if provoked. That's what we can't have happen. Treating a portion of the crew differently, as if they're subhuman, doesn't seem the best move for morale, Captain. This has nothing to do with any of that, the captain said. We're one crew, a big, happy family working together to execute our role as flawlessly as humanly possible. Have to maintain that and motivate all hands. Personally, insulting crewmen isn't the best way to reach those goals. You're not talking about the risk of hurt feelings, are you, Smokey? I don't care about hurt feelings. I'm just interested in operational excellence. Maintaining order is a huge step in that direction. That's all this is. Nothing personal to anyone. Porter stood there and absorbed it. Is there anything else? The captain asked with another wave of his half-eaten sandwich. With a head shake and a casual about face, Porter left. He took with him a taste like ammonia in the back of his throat and a feeling of bricks on his back. The brothers were outnumbered, but through vengeance and the element of surprise, they swung fists and weapons and dominated the berthing compartment. The unprepared white guys proved no match for the rampaging black crew who pulled guys out of their racks with a series of tugs, slugs, yanks, kicks, and punches. Applewhite left the Elvis-looking guy bleeding in his aisle. Applewhite's chest swelled with the satisfaction. Sirico would be pissed that the guy responsible for ratting on him had been dealt with, even though he would never make that mistake again. Applewhite's rage burned in his veins until he sprang into the main aisle, looking for other white skulls to crack. It no longer mattered if what they were doing was right or wrong. None of those white guys did anything to Applewhite, but they were all part of the system that made life more difficult than it needed to be for him and his brothers. He spit on mattresses and pillows as he passed, wiped his feet on blankets. He'd make every one of those white bastards pay if he could, even if that meant death. This was all one small step in that direction. Make Whitey pay, he yelled. None of them were totally innocent. After 5 minutes or so, Applewhite grabbed Wooly by the arm. Spread the word to the brothers that we're moving on. They moved as a mob through the berthing space to the far end and out the door, up the ladder, down the passageway, hooting and hollering and ripping memos and schedules off of squadron room doors. Some grabbed dogging wrenches and firefighting nozzles and bashed any white boy in their path. They walked into workshops and storage rooms and trashed them. Airplane parts would take days to reorganize, especially the small parts, loose in bins. They spilled like boxes of nails. The mob cheered and pounded on bulkheads, pipes, electrical panels, and transformers. He recognized the collective breathing, all those brothers around him taking in oxygen and using it to cool their engines. It reminded him of the riot in his hometown when he was a kid. They stopped at a ladder well in the passageway. That's another berthing compartment down there, right? A bunch of office boys down there, Wooly said. White ones. Applewhite dapped Wooly. that's about to be shitting themselves. Walk on with your bad self, Woolley said as he pulled a firefighting foam applicator off the bulkhead. The Navy called it a wand, but it was a pipe bent like a hockey stick and with a chunk of brass the size of a grapefruit at the business end. Applewhite took the steps confidently into the berthing compartment. A group of 30 brothers crowded behind him. The shouts and smacks echoed down the narrow aisles of racks. On the opposite end, a white boy lunged at the bulkhead and flipped on all the light switches, flooding the room in fluorescent light as bright as daylight. "The blacks are on a rampage," he hollered. "Wake your asses up and defend yourselves." Applewhite saw a pale postal clerk cowering in his rack so pathetically that he looked like a little kid during a storm. At the first image made, Applewhite recalled his childhood summers down at his aunt's house in Alabama. But after that initial flash, Applewhite saw his own son being afraid, all alone. "It's your lucky day," he told the postal clerk, and then walked off, only to turn back and see Woolley holding onto the top rack for the leverage of getting enormous kicks into the postal clerk's bottom rack. Applewhite kept walking to the sound of the postal clerk calling out, "Oh God, please no." Applewhite figured there were more than 200 brothers fighting all over the ship by this point. He knew it wouldn't take long before the bridge got wind of it and dispatched the Marines. Applewhite went from group to group of riding brothers and told half to meet him on the aft mess decks and the other half on the forecastle, figuring the split would confuse the Marines and maybe buy them time. With the Red Devils he'd swallowed fully circulating through his system, Applewhite felt invincible and hungry for blood. He didn't question why they looked to him as their leader.
I hope you enjoyed today's co-creative listening experience. Please remember to leave a comment about the single greatest takeaway for you today. You know, that one thing you will remember from this day forward. Was it something funny or provocative? Was it just what you needed to hear? Please share so we can all benefit. And remember to return Tuesdays and Thursdays to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life.